Hi folks, hope all is well. This is Jim Carroll, welcoming you to a special series of Banter Podcasts recorded at the Web Summit in Lisbon earlier this month. There is a first time for everything, and this was Banter's first ever encounter with a bishop. Paul Tigh is a Navan-born bishop who is part of the Vatican team, who put the Pope on Twitter, and has been a member of various influential Catholic Church councils on communications and culture. He talks here about what the Church has been doing in the realm of social media and culture, and what else it hopes to do. Please excuse the background noise on the podcast. The Banter stage of Web Summit was located in the main hall, and there was a lot of very busy coming and going behind us.
Day two of Banter here at Web Summit. My name is Jim Carroll. If you want to find out more about Banter, please check thisisbanter.com. What we're doing here are long-form, casual, informal conversations with interesting people that we've come across at Web Summit. And this next man we're going to talk to here is actually he's a fellow countryman of mine. Bishop Paul Tigh. He hails from Navan in County Meath. And you're the man who basically put the Pope on Twitter.
I'm one of the team who put the Pope on Twitter. I wouldn't want to claim to be the one.
Let's leave that for a second then, Paul.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll obviously come to that. I'm curious about, like, I mean, when you were growing up in Navan, did you get a vocation early on, or was it late? And did you have an idea in your head when you had your vocation, what you wanted to do?
No. I'm being very honest. I grew up in Navan when my dad worked in local government, so we moved around a little bit. So I was in Navan until I was 12 or 13. Then we moved to Sligo, and then my parents moved to Dublin eventually when I was about 17 or 18. So Navan, I suppose, is formative. But I suppose one of the things that happened growing up in a town like Navan, on the outskirts of Navan, there was a big missionary institute, the Columban Fathers, who had priests in China, who then relocated to Africa. So we grew up in schools with, like, if the Latin teacher was sick, one of the Columbans came in. So we knew a lot. And I got interested in the missionary thing. And then probably moved on. I was going to do medicine. That was my decision. And then coming up towards leaving cert, somebody I know was quite sick. And they got great medical assistance. But actually went through a kind of crisis. What's life all about, or what is it? And I had always found a certain reassurance, in a sense, of coming from my own faith being important to me. That it, you know, we'd been moving houses, we'd been moving, lots of things were changing. And that was something, without being overly religious or engaged, it was something that was important to me. And I decided I would explore that. My parents were a little shocked and concerned about the idea that I was going to. They had always said, whatever you want to do, we will support you. And then I come, what was maybe in Ireland at the time, seen as almost the most traditional calling or vocation. And I think that was a bit hard on them. But I learned into a seminary in Dublin age 17, very young.
So that would have been kind of like before John Paul II. That would be like
late 70s. Yeah, 1975, I went into a seminary in Dublin. I went in really to explore this possibility. I went in also with no guarantees that it was going to happen. Found myself with a group of other people who were many of exploring it as well. The first year went reasonably well, and then the question came about going to university. My parents were keen that I would have a serviceable qualification when I left university, and as they probably half expected me maybe to move on from the seminary. So I did a law degree in UCD, and that I really loved. That has shaped my way of thinking and reflecting.
Yeah.
Many of my friends come from that group. They're now all a bit older. They're distinguished lawyers and judges. But I've remained friendly with many of those. But equally in all of that time, my own sense that essentially, I mean, my feeling was I wanted to be able to tell people about a God who loved them, that you don't have to keep proving yourself and earning approval, but God's love is free. It's there for you. And that's not a very sophisticated theology, but that remained the thing that I was committed to and that I've stayed committed to.
Okay, so, I mean, you was your first posting then after you were ordained to Ballyfermot, or were you somewhere before Ballyfermot?
No, I went straight to Ballyfermot, and I was sent in to teach in a place called Ballyfermot Senior College, which was a very, almost
very
experimental,
very progressive. And James Morrissey, wasn't it?
And before that there had been a Dominican sister. But I arrived in there. I hadn't been in a classroom since I left school. I had no training. I was a disastrous teacher. But
what were you teaching for?
I was teaching religion, and I was teaching civics, if you remember. That was a subject in those days. And I was probably a lot more competent on civics than I was talking religion. But I enjoyed it. It was also by the Irish of the early 1980s. It would have been seen as you couldn't have said it was a majorly secular environment, but it was probably more secular than most environments. And I enjoyed it. I had 1 year there, really loved it. And then I was asked to go back and do postgraduate studies in Rome. And I remember being, at the beginning, being frightened going almost to Ballyfermot, and then being desperately sad when I had to leave after 1 year.
Because, I mean, like, I mean, at that stage, probably, that was probably the late 70s, late, early
83, 84.
I mean, Ballyfermot was a fairly rough area.
Yeah, that was a perception. Yeah, that was a wrong perception. But it had a, but there were fantastic people there. And I really got to like the people. And I remember that my first day teaching in the school, the parish priest was a man called Peter Lamass, a well-known Irish priest. And he said to me, Cole, you have to decide you're going to like and love these people. Otherwise, there's no point in me here. And I remember another thing my mother gave me a bit of advice to was, I remember we were a bit concerned in the area. People were celebrating First Communions and Confirmations and having big, lavish celebrations. And we were trying to say, do it simply, do it simply. And my mother's saying to me, Paul, you're not there to spread middle-class values. You know, if people want to celebrate, and they may not have a lot to celebrate in life, embrace it and don't be there in judgment. Yeah.
So, like, what was your next step then after Ballyfermot? Was that then to the diocesan office?
Ballyfermot off back to Rome, and I spent the following 6 years in Rome doing postgraduate studies. Came back then to Dublin in 1990 and began working in what was then the seminary in Dublin, which was a fairly lively environment. It died out over the next 10 years. And teaching also at a place called Mater Dei, which is a teacher training college. Small teacher training college. Again, loved it. And my own areas, because I had done law and because I had studied ethics, I ended up doing a lot of work on the interface of law and morality and getting into the big Irish debates of the time and teaching also in the hospitals and doing work in the whole area of bioethics.
Yeah.
So that became maybe my interface was with the world of medicine and with the world of education. Yeah.
And like me, you said that was a very lively time. It was a very lively time in the Irish Church. I mean, there was a lot of debates going on. There was a lot of kind of, I suppose, friction as well.
Well, there were lots of things happening. One level, the institution was in some ways in free fall. You could almost use it like compared to the very powerful institution. There were a lot of debates, maybe more, not so much necessarily within the church as between the church and society. And maybe it's part of the thing that I really appreciated having had a legal training, because I felt I always had a foot in another world, not just the world of the church. And I didn't see the two as foreign to each other. And I tried to walk and so know the language of society and also know the values. So very often I would have spent my time defending the church for people who were outside the church, and then defending them from people who were maybe criticizing them from within the church. So I became interested in that position of somehow trying to facilitate dialogue and discussion between church and a rapidly changing society, and not getting caught up in the nastiness of that.
I mean, dialogue and discussion equals communication. So, I mean, you were instrumental in saying, kind of like, I suppose, putting the Dublin Diocese on a proper communications footing,
weren't
you?
That was an accident. That happened in 2004. Dermot Markle, who was a friend of mine, came back as Archbishop of Dublin and said, I want you to take on the communications office. I said, I don't really want to. And then he said to me, do you think I wanted to be Archbishop of Dublin? So that was the immediate, you know. So I took it on. And the first thing I did.
Why didn't you want to do it? Did you find it?
I enjoyed my teaching. I loved teaching. And I wasn't sure. I didn't know the world of media terribly well. So the first thing I did was I asked him, can I have permission to bring on board a professional journalist? And we brought on Annette O'Donnell, who had worked at RTE. And Annette came in and she took over the communications. And I developed, parallel with the communications office, what was called an Office for Public Affairs. And that office really was, in a sense, Annette came from the secular world. I was there as a theological resource, somebody who knew the church world. And then it also, Dermot Martin had just come back from Ireland after being away for 30 years. So helping him to build links to politics, to economics, and he didn't need long or much assistance in that. But that's where I was positioned then for about 3 years. And then out of the blue, phone call telling me the nuncio wanted to see me and said, yesterday the Pope nominated you to go and work in Rome. You've 3 hours to think about it. If there's something you're aware of that prevents you, that's fine. But the fact that your parents are in their 80s isn't sufficient excuse. So that was my excuse gone. So then I moved to Rome 9 years ago now.
Is that was the Pope Benedict who gave you the call, wasn't it?
Yeah. But it was on behalf of Pope Benedict, the Vatican machine. I mean, But I had known him, and when I came back and began working, he did seem to recognize me. So, and that, and I went to work in the area of communications in the Vatican. I came without a strong communications background, but in some ways I think that was actually a blessing, because my boss was a man called Archbishop Celli, who had been a diplomat. I'd been a teacher, essentially. We didn't come either from print or from radio or from TV, so the thing we felt most familiar with was we were straight into the digital. And we didn't have the traditional loyalty to our medium. And we began immediately trying to say the church has to reorganize itself globally if it's going to impact on the Indian more digital environment. And that began trying to say to people, okay, we have radios, we have TV stations, we have newspapers, we have websites, but we have to do all this differently because it's not just the technologies are changing, it's the culture.
Did you have any idea, Paul, how you came to be on their radar so they make that call to you in 2007? I mean, I'm curious about that because, I mean, you said you were surprised by it.
Yeah.
You know, like, was there some particular part of work you'd done? Had Archbishop Martin recommended you?
I think it's a mixture of different things. Very often in the church, you never know what they're doing. I never know what they're doing. I think they know what they're doing at times. But, no, I think what probably happened, they wanted an English speaker. And the previous person working the area had been American. So they wanted an English speaker, not American. And then they looked, I think, Australia, Ireland, and Britain, and people were canvassed, and I think my name was put forward by the nuncio in Ireland at the time, and then that's where it took off from. Yeah.
So you're in the Vatican, you're working with kind of like, I mean, the former diplomat, you've got your kind of structure in place. You know, I'm curious about, because you said something there very interesting. You said it was digital first. I mean, you immediately immersed yourself in that particular world. You know, what at that stage was the Vatican's digital policy like? If you were doing a content audit of what was going on, what did they have?
I mean, all the individual institutions had a website. So you had a Vatican radio website, you had a press office website, the newspaper had a fragile enough web presence, but they were all dispersed. They were all scattered across different platforms, and you really would have needed a degree in IT to find the sites. So the thing we began saying is, look, we have to do an integrated platform. And the first platform we launched was a thing called news.va, which we set up a portal which took the content in the five or six different languages from the different Vatican media things and then tried to make it after the fact multimedia. So take a picture from one group, the text from another, and the sound from the radio and stitch it together. And that led to a realization that if we wanted to do this properly, we'd have to have a reform of the structures. But more importantly than that was maybe a realization that Church, Vatican, we tended to be very much one direction of communications. We're used to a pulpit, we're used to the microphone, we're used to the radio became another more sophisticated microphone, and TV meant people could see us as well as hear us. But really the thing that became very clear was that in the digital environment, unless you're actually engaging an audience, unless you're responding to questions, things that maybe the local church had always been good at, you're not going to get traction. So that was the next thing as we began to develop and look at some of the social media platforms, was how could we develop an interactivity, not necessarily just at the Vatican, but at the church globally. And they were, I suppose, the two things that led to a reform process, began 2 years ago, led by Lord Christopher Patton, which said, let's look at building a digital-first approach to the Vatican's media, and let's also study how we can make that more interactive, or at least provide materials that allows the local church to be more interactive.
I mean, you've a quote on this, and you kind of said the message the church communicates is not a message of its own making. I mean, was that a hard kind of learning for people within the Vatican, within the Curia, to actually accept? Because you talked there about like being on the pulpit, you know, and like for many people, I suppose they've grown up within the church with that culture of speaking down. Whereas, like, I mean, suddenly you don't actually control the message anymore.
Yeah. No, I think two things on that. That quote about, you know, that the message is not a message of our own making, that was one we used to have to do more with marketeers who come into advisors in the Vatican, and you need to reshape your teaching and do your focus groups. We said, well, there's certain core teaching, really, we didn't invent it, and, you know, if maybe said, well, love one another, could we tone that down? We can't really, you know. So we have to stay with what are our, you know, there are certain givens, and some of those are not very well received.
Brand values.
Well, I don't think I'd like to use brand values. And the other thing that we've always been very clear is that we're not actually trying to get people a message. We're trying to invite them into a relationship with a person.
Yeah.
And that actually, in a social media environment, actually begins to make more sense. So, no, the thing that I think that maybe I learned about communications does two things. Exchanges information. That's the easy bit. And it builds relationships. So, therefore, very often we talk to somebody. It's not that we've anything to say, but it's keeping in touch with the person. And in the church, I think they're the two things we were trying to build. So we spread information, and that's important. But then for certain people in certain parts of the world, it gives them a sense of belonging to something. So when the Pope, and I don't want to skip ahead here, but when the Pope went on Twitter, one of the places we saw the highest uptake were in the Gulf States.
Gulf States?
Which seemed very strange. And what we discovered was Filipino workers who were Catholic, who couldn't practice their faith in that environment, or only could very difficult, and had this sense of connection, so that the communication wasn't what the Pope was saying, it was the sense of, they had a sense of belonging. And these are, I think, things that we learned. So one of the things we began to try and model for people in the church was to say, look, your local parish priest was often very good at talking with people and conversing with people, and that communication was every bit as important as maybe the same man was not necessarily very articulate when he stood up on a platform to speak, and to say that social media is inviting more of that conversational than that preaching or that bombarding people.
You mentioned there, Paul, you mentioned about, like me, that the cross-organizational review that Chris Patt was involved in, you know, you're part of that kind of process.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about what was, like, I'm curious from almost from a kind of a business management point of view, from an organizational point of view, what was involved in that? And, like, did everyone fall, was there any kind of, like, I suppose, pressure points that you hadn't anticipated that came to surface?
No, in fairness, we're in an environment in the Vatican where there were about 600 people working in communications. The vast majority of them, about 400, were working on a radio station that broadcasts in 41 languages. So it's not that, no PR department was the good, but there were 400 people and radio was their life. It's about 80 or 90 working on a newspaper and print was their life. We had about 10 or 15 running the press office, which is hopelessly inadequate in responding to. So what we said is, look, the structures we have are the result of history rather than strategy. And they're all siloed. Everybody has their own management, has their own budget, and does their own thing, including in the digital. So we had not so much multiplication, we had multiplication rather than duplication. So we had extraordinary waste of energy. So we had maybe 5 people translating from Italian into English, one at the radio, one at the newspaper, one at the TV station, and one at the website. So we said, can we begin to integrate all of those? And the basic core of the plan was to say, you need to collect one management, one budget, and it will integrate all the existing structures and create something that's more multimedia and that gets people flowing and working between. And that's frightening for people.
Totally.
It's frightening because it means I went into my office, I knew what I did, and I knew the people I worked with, and now you're asking me to change.
Yeah.
And that's why the project was approved and initiated about a year ago. And the two people who are running that project now, one is a Monsignor Vigano, who comes from the world of cinema, and the other is an Argentinian who's a very highly qualified technology person. And they are leading that change. And part of that change is convincing people it's going to be difficult for the moment, but it's worth it in the long term. One of the things that maybe, unlike other organizations, the Vatican, Pope Francis was very clear, he said, no job losses, you can't kick people out. You keep everybody's job as secured, but you're maybe asking them to go through a lot of change.
So before we go on to kind of like, I suppose, your new role in the Vatican, you mentioned Pope Francis there, and you said earlier on about Pope Francis going on social media for the first time. So talk to me about that, because, I mean, like, obviously, you know, you've got a lot of attention, good and bad.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, was he aware of the risks in
advance? Actually, the first one, strangely, was Pope Benedict, before Pope Francis, who said, yes, let's open a Twitter account. Now, obviously, Pope Benedict at the time was 85 years of age. Twitter was not his world. Internet was not his world. So briefing documents were prepared. The people who presented them said, he kind of looked and he said, look, in a new, you know, summing it up, you're saying this is a platform that will allow me to share short messages of hope with people who otherwise might never encounter the church. Yes, he said, okay, go for it. I don't need to know anything else. So it was launched. And immediately there was a bombardment of negativity. And I was probably more aware of it than anybody because I had promised to monitor the reactions. Some people in the Vatican said, oh, we have to get the Pope out of this environment. Others, we said, look, if you want to withdraw from the digital, the people who don't like you will be very empowered and they'll want you out of every other environment. The other thing then that people said was, digital space is very nasty. It's kind of full of trolls. But we said, well, if people who have good intentions abandon it, then we're handing it over. So it became a thing about, one was the importance itself, but secondly, of saying to people, be there, don't be contaminated by the negative side of the culture, and try and see if we can use it for good. And that's not just believers, that's people from very different perspectives who are saying, we can't abandon this, despite the roughness and the trolling and the negativity. But I mean, even, you know, you'd hate to see people who have sensitive around their values not feeling they could be there any longer.
Yeah. And like, what was kind of Benedict and Francis aware of what was going on? I'm assuming that Benedict didn't have an iPhone.
No. Flashing up with notifications. In fact, something that happened was nobody really knew about the negativity because they didn't really know what Twitter was until one Italian newspaper decided very helpfully to publish 3 pages of the most virulent criticisms, and suddenly it's all over the place. And some of the older people in the Vatican got very upset. And I have to say, my boss at the time, this former diplomat, Archbishop Celli, was extraordinary. They had trust in him. And he said, look, we have to stay there. This is deadly serious. It's worth it. And we stuck it. And I think then everybody now sees this as an enormous... And Pope Francis, once elected, said, stay there. And then the thing has... I mean, it crossed the language platforms. There's 35 million or something like that. It's not Beyonce. It's not many, not even One Direction. I think we're not up at those levels yet. But it's an important platform. And more importantly, it's a symbol to church leaders that they can't dismiss the digital. And they have to think themselves what their strategies might look like. So Pope Francis himself was very interested in social media. And in its, not as, he's not a practitioner, he doesn't watch television. But he said, I don't want Catholics going in there and trying to be, he didn't use the language, but the holy Joes, like, you know, bombarding people with religion. He said, no, I want you to be good neighbors. Be good neighbors in an environment where you have lots of different people. Listen to them first. Try and understand what people's concerns and worries and hopes and expectations are. Then become part of the conversation. And then he said, let your hallmark be encouraging. Be a slightly more positive voice. And he says that without knowing the environment, but I think his intuitions were good on that.
Yeah, but like, you know, that's also goes back, Paul, to where you came in initially, like what your vocation was and why you decided to be a priest. So it kind of strikes me, and again, apologies for using this language, but the brand values are sound. So basically, like, that basically informs everything you do.
Yeah, I think, I mean, this year in the church is known as the Year of Mercy. And mercy is a strange concept, but mercy basically says God loves you. It doesn't matter where you've been, how you've failed, what mistakes, how successful or unsuccessful you are. It's not about having to perform or merit. It's a gift. And that, I think, is a value that, for me, is fundamentally good news for anybody. And in an environment like this, we have so many people working so hard to prove themselves, to be winners, to capture attention. I think there's something good in saying, no, your real dignity and your real worth is actually because you are who you are, for your achievements. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, you're in a new role now in the Vatican.
Yeah.
So are you here to represent that new role?
I'm probably a hangover from a bit of the old role, and a little bit now I'm here because I think we began seeing, look, people began seeing digital as a change of technology. I said, no, it's more than that. Okay, it's changing media. Yeah, but it's more than that. It's changing how people communicate. But even more, it's changing how people form their identity, have a sense of themselves, form community, and that's, we're straight into culture. Yeah. So the council I work in now has always been interested in saying, how does the church dialogue with people who don't have religious view, are not religious? And one of the places we have to meet is in the world of culture. So very often, once you begin to explore the themes, the world of art, particularly contemporary art, seems a million miles away from the world of religion. But the world of religion traditionally was very invested in art. So can we begin a dialogue and say, maybe it's artists today can help us be aware and see more about our world and alert us to values. And whether they're people of faith or believers or not, can we as a church learn from them? And can we, in fact, support them in different ways?
Well, I mean, that's kind of almost like a classic disruptor's dilemma in some ways. I mean, you're taking kind of like leanings and you're taking direction from people who are not necessarily in your own sphere. So how have they reacted to these kind of like these, I suppose, these approaches?
I mean, I think probably with suspicion at the beginning. And, you know, and very often people in the church are a little bit suspicious of people who are not in the church. But very often when you begin a proper discussion, and the word we're trying to use, it's the buzzword, but it's dialogue. Dialogue for me is a discussion where you believe that the other person may have something to give you. That it's not just about, I listen so that I can answer all your objections or prove I'm right. It's a belief that we actually learn that diversity is actually a richness. So one of the things, there's a bit of suspicion, obviously, but there's been great initiatives emerging, and particularly if you focus not on who we are and where we come from, but on a thematic or something that interests us. So let's like take the world. Recently we had a thing on the world of sport and inviting all the different world religions and people from the more secular end of thing to talk about sport as a phenomenally important human, something that enriches human life. And yet there's a crisis at the moment. Can we really trust what we see on our screens? Can we believe all the results that we, can we have heroes in the same way any longer? How can the world of faith work with other people to ensure good values? For example, at the practical level, how can we ensure that all our very open church facilities become where sports happen? How do we make that more inclusive? How do we ensure that they are environments that it's not all about winning? Because if it's all about winning, sport is finished. So these are kind of strange, kind of out of the mainstream conversations that bring together people of different interests. Another one coming up, which we look at literature, and you kind of, I mean, that's certainly for me, some of the best reflection going on digital culture is happening from some writers, contemporary writers like David Eggers, Jonathan Frentzen, Purity. And they can say things, and maybe with a liberty that the artist has, that can raise questions about a culture. Not saying it's all bad, but a little warning about other aspects of digital culture. So the David Eggers, I think, particularly on the addictive nature of digital culture. Frentzen, I think, is alerting us to a lot of big egos in this world as well. Yeah. And I think the artist can very much prod the conscience. And I'd like to see if the church can be part of that conversation afterwards.
I mean, it's really commendable. It's a really good idea because, I mean, obviously, as well, when you reach into these areas, like you say, you're saying about the suspicion, you know, and you can probably understand where that suspicion comes from. But there's also a willingness to have a dialogue with people from outside your tent. I mean, I really see that in culture more and more, like, say, from a music point of view or literature.
Yeah.
That, like, because things have changed so much, because there's been so much disruption because of digital, we have to reach out to other people and bring them into the tent.
Well, I mean, it's kind of a little trivial, but two of the maybe music world, two particular pieces over the last year share the same name, Take Me to Church, one from Hozier, one from Sinead O'Connor, coming from very different places, but they're talking about church, you know, and in some sense we might run away frightened, and you can understand that, but I think it's saying there's something in the human spirit is kind of saying, yeah, we're not fully dismissing this, that there might be something more.
I think you're right. I mean, as a music writer, like, I mean, there's many times when I'm listening to a new album, and like, this is something that comes true, particularly with even with hip hop artists, the element of spirituality that's there, and the realization that it's more than just like making money.
Yeah, well, I can't go in depth on the music. I'm probably stuck somewhere in the late 1970s with the Undertones. But, so in reality, though, there's, you know, and even something like music, it's the mood of our lives. And what is it saying? I mean, one project, really fascinating one, if you don't, last year in London was the teacher of modern art in King's College was a Jewish guy who was really interested in modern art and religion and spirituality. And he suggested, let's do a Stations of the Cross, 14 stopping points across London, starting with some recognized Renaissance art in the museums, going into some more contemporary art in some of the churches, and inviting non-believers and believing artists to do some of the other stations. And let's have a reflection on the journey of Jesus as the journey of the human person who tries to live well, who suffers for that. Let's see how we represent that as artists. And that invited people in a non-threatening environment to think about something, probably drew them into churches, drew others into museums who wouldn't frequent museums, and builds that we're all on the same journey and can we learn from each other. And in a sense, it means that some people say, but that's a bit unfocused or whatever, but I think it's appealing to the goodness of people and learning to walk together.
Last couple of questions, Paul, and I really appreciate you giving us the time to. I know you're very, very busy. What, like, I mean, you've been here for kind of like, you were here yesterday as well, weren't you?
I came on Monday.
Okay, so what have you enjoyed about Web Summit? What have you learned about Web Summit? I mean, what have been the most interesting, I suppose, findings you've taken away from this trip?
Well, I came here to listen and to get around and see much stuff, but in fact, the program they had created for me was quite busy, so I didn't do as much of that. But what I've been able to do is one thing, the first thing that hits me here is energy, dynamism, enthusiasm, okay? And that's, you can't deny. The other thing is listening in on some of the conversations. I see one thing that I really like, and I think it's a concern, people are realizing that digital communications, which theoretically has the capacity to build a platform that allows all people to interact with each other, has lost its way a little bit, and we've got caught in little filter bubbles or echo chambers, and where we're stuck talking to our own and reassuring one another that we're right and the others are all Neanderthals or that they are progressives, and that we're not, and that I think there is an appetite for people to say, how can we actually find a way of talking to each other, building on what we share in common rather than reinforcing our stereotypes? And I think, and it's not going to be easy, and ultimately that technology won't do that. Good communications is the thing Pope Francis said. Good communications is a human achievement, not a technological achievement.
Well, it just seems so entrenched, Paul. I mean, this week in particular, I'm looking at my timeline, and I'm your, middle-class liberal dude, so I'm looking at my timeline, and it's all like, oh, Hillary Day's poor Hillary Dad, down with Trump. You know, I'm sure if I was kind of on the other side, and I was looking at kind of like the Republican side, it'd be like, yeah, hey, it's a victory for us. It just strikes me that, like, you it's amazing you kind of pointed out that, but it strikes me that those positions are so entrenched that I'm kind of going like, how can you change that?
I think one of the first thing is it's about recovering certain basic human values, and maybe we have to look at this as the ability to reflect. I think in Ireland we're lucky, despite the divisions in our society, and they're very strong. Very often the person on the other side of the argument is my cousin, or somebody I went to school with, or, you know, I see this in my own family, you know, and I think it forces us to have a model of communications, and that even if it's only to shut up and say nothing for peace sake at the family table, I think something, it's about creating an environment and creating a sense, you know, of being able to rediscover the capacity to listen to another person. And I think one of the things that worries me a little bit, when I grew up in the country, and the lovely thing about growing up in the country was there was one school, and we all went there. I come to Dublin, and there's people who went to rather nice schools, and there's people who went to different schools, and they don't interact. They don't know each other. They don't know each other's worlds. So one of the things I think is we need to create more and more platforms, or more occasions, events, where people mix. And, I mean, it's a problem even within the church. We have people who identify themselves as progressive Catholics and people who identify themselves as traditional Catholics, and they can get nasty with each other. Despite the fact we share beliefs, and maybe for the rest of the world we're crazy Catholics, whether we're liberal or not. And I think one of the things we need to try and do is to recover that capacity, I think, possibly for face-to-face communication, but face-to-face communication with people who aren't immediately in our circles. And maybe that's, I think, really where that comes, is around particular interests which unify broader thing. And I know that sounds very vague, but one of the things I think the churches can do is try and be sponsor kind of events, ideas, interactions. So at the Vatican, we're trying to do things like, say, the Vatican opened a stall at the Biennale at Venice. So suddenly the Vatican is in this world of kind of rather strange and modern art. Could that be done at a local level?
Yes.
So could a parish somewhere in Dublin say, we have a school of design in our let's invite them to do something and create just awarenesses of each other.
Listen, I really appreciate your time. We could talk for a lot longer, but I'm aware you've got other commitments. So thank you very much, Paul, for your time.
You.
Paul Tighe.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Many thanks to Paul for joining us at Banter, and thanks to Dara, Eleanor, Catherine, James, Kira and Richard at Web Summit, and local crew Josh, Caesar and Ricardo for all their help with Banter in Lisbon. This podcast was produced by Banter series producer Tanya White. Be sure to check out the other podcasts from Banter at Web Summit, and check thisisbanter.com for news where we're up to at Banter. Thanks for listening. Talk to you again real soon.